It's Thursday, December 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, diplomats gathered to try to curb fighting and help civilians in Syria.
You can't defeat radical Islam from our shores. You have to be on the ground over there. And you can't maintain victory without a follow-on presence.
Lawmakers debate Trump security strategies. Also ahead, remembering Pearl Harbor 75 years later, soaring financial markets, and bluegrass music underground. It's all on today's International Edition. A coalition of nations led by the United States called for an immediate ceasefire in Aleppo and condemned Russia for interfering with attempts to bring humanitarian aid to those civilians trapped in the Syrian city. The leaders of those countries, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Britain, and the United States, called on the Syrian government to agree to the UN's plan in Aleppo and allow humanitarian aid into the city. Syrian rebels have agreed to a five-day ceasefire to ensure the humanitarian evacuation of civilians from the eastern part of the city. State Department spokesman Mark Toner, as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry prepared to hold talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Hamburg, Germany.
It is about trying to find a way to, as I said, bring about a pause in the fighting. And we all know the elements involved in that, and certainly one of those is the opposition, and finding a way for them to either get passage out of Aleppo or to find some way to at least bring about a pause in the fighting so that humanitarian assistance and medical assistance can get in to Aleppo.
Kerry, who was in Brussels on Tuesday to participate in his final meeting with NATO foreign ministers, said he hopes to relaunch peace talks between the Syrian regime and the opposition, but has received little help from the government of President Bashar al-Assad. The rebels made the ceasefire proposal Wednesday morning, just hours after Syria's Russian-backed army gained control of at least three-quarters of Aleppo's old city, which had been under rebel control since 2012. It's time for us now, an International Edition, to check out what's buzzing on the Internet. Our social media reporter is G. Abby Lee. She joins me in the studio. Hi, G.
Hello, Jim.
What's trending?
We talked about the Time magazine's Reader's Choice for the Person of the Year Tuesday, and on Wednesday, the magazine announced its pick. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump is the 2016 Person of the Year, and the magazine's cover describes him as the president of the divided states of America.
Okay, that's a little bit of a controversial description.
Those are fighting words. And not surprisingly, some people are calling it a clickbait cover. Tom Stokes, a TV producer, replied to the American magazine's announcement on Twitter, and he tweeted, "Why produce this as divided states of America? You are one of the many that fuels a fire of division with crappy statements like this." Now, to that tweet, an apparent Hillary Clinton supporter replied, "Trump is hashtag not my president," and stressed that the Democratic candidate won the popular vote.
Wow. Well, what are the reactions like from experts in the media?
So here's an interesting one. Republican strategist Anna Navarro tweeted, "It's hard to argue with the magazine's selection because Trump defied political gravity." But other people were less impressed because the magazine makes the U.S. president-elect its Person of the Year every 4 years. Still others emphasize that it's not really a compliment per se because it's given to the most influential person of that year, good or bad. Even Adolf Hitler was selected as a Person of the Year in 1938, and usually you don't want to be in the same category as Hitler.
Indeed. Well, is there anything else trending today?
Mm-hmm. Over in India, thousands are paying tribute to the Iron Lady of Tamil Nadu. Jayalalitha Jayaram entertained and also served as a politician in the South Indian state for more than half a century, until she passed away from cardiac arrest earlier this week. The country's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, sent out multiple tweets about her legacy and also shared a photo of himself offering flowers at her funeral. There are also photos of people dressed in traditional Indian garbs with her photos imprinted on the fabric. Jim?
Well, thank you for the analysis, G. And you may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson. And, of course, we invite you to follow our International Edition Twitter stream. That's found at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in Africa, Ghana awaits election results. Kenya NGO releases extrajudicial killings report. African Union official calls for accountability in South Sudan sexual violence. Forces retake Somali town held by pro-Islamic State fighters. Careful steps ahead for Catholic Church tasked with pulling Congo back from crisis. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, take the news with you by using our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Republicans in Congress appear divided over President-elect Donald Trump's repeated statements against military intervention on the world stage. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman reports.
Addressing supporters in North Carolina Tuesday, President-elect Trump pledged to end what he termed a destructive cycle of intervention and chaos and said the United States, quote, will stop racing to topple foreign regimes that we know nothing about, that we shouldn't be involved with.
You're going to be involved whether you want to be or not.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham provided what he described as his two cents of advice for Trump.
You can't defeat radical Islam from our shores. You have to be on the ground over there. And you can't maintain victory without a follow-on presence.
Trump also formally announced he has chosen retired Marine General James Mattis as his nominee for Secretary of Defense. Mattis is no stranger to U.S. military interventions. He commanded a Marine division during the 2003 invasion of Iraq and later oversaw U.S. operations in Afghanistan and Iraq as head of U.S. Central Command. Trump's choice of Mattis was applauded by Republican John McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and a tireless advocate of a more assertive U.S. role on the world stage.
Obviously, he knows what he's getting with General Mattis, but General Mattis, obviously, he and I share the same view about the importance of American leadership.
Some Republicans, like Senator Richard Shelby, have warmed to the president-elect's statements on U.S. military might.
We can't govern the world. We don't want to govern the world. We don't want to be the world's policeman.
Non-interventionism is more commonly advocated by left-of-center Democrats than right-leaning Republicans. But Democrats like Senator Chris Murphy, who agree, at least conceptually, with Trump's anti-regime change message, say they do not trust the messenger.
When George Bush was running for his election in 2000, he told us that he wasn't going to be toppling any regimes either. And then he put a bunch of people in the State Department and the Defense Department who were committed to toppling regimes.
While advocating a judicious use of American military power, Trump nevertheless pledged to defeat Islamic State and other terrorist groups. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
China has called on the United States to turn down any request by Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen for transit through the U.S. to Guatemala when she visits that Central American nation next month. A U.S. State Department spokesman said granting such a transit request has been part of a long-standing U.S. practice for the safety, comfort, and convenience of the Taiwan leader. It is the latest development in a dispute sparked by President-elect Donald Trump's decision to accept a congratulatory phone call from the Taiwan leader last Friday. That prompted a strong protest from Beijing and warnings of dire consequences to bilateral ties in Chinese state-run media. Speaking Tuesday to the Washington Post and other media outlets, Ms. Tsai downplayed her phone call, saying that it should not be seen as a significant shift in the U.S. one-China policy, which, since 1979, has recognized Beijing as the sole representative of the Chinese nation. She added that we all see the value of stability in the region. The associate editor of the Asia-Pacific current affairs publication, The Diplomat, Ankit Panda, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Taiwan's leader position is the correct one.
Essentially, the status quo, which is complicated, but I can go into more detail on that, has been beneficial to the United States, to China, and to Taiwan. And I don't think that there is a serious attempt, at least on the part of either the United States under the incoming administration or the Tsai administration, to seriously upend the status quo. And by seriously upend, I mean Taiwan making a move towards either de jure independence, legal independence, which would be a red line for China, potentially sparking conflict, or for the United States to consider either reestablishing diplomatic ties with Taiwan or significantly increasing its military support for Taipei or offering assurances that Washington would back Taiwan in the case that Taiwan unilaterally wanted to declare independence.
And, Kit, are you surprised by the extent and depth of the Chinese negative reaction to this phone call?
Not surprised at all, actually. I should note, though, that I was a little taken aback by the foreign ministry's fairly muted reaction to the phone call. The Chinese foreign ministry effectively blamed Taiwan for playing a little trick and didn't directly or publicly address the incoming U.S. administration. However, the foreign ministry spokesperson strongly implied that the Chinese side had gotten in contact with Trump's team about the phone call. The reaction in China more broadly is unsurprising. Taiwan is effectively seen as a sovereign piece of Chinese territory, according to the Beijing government, and the Chinese public sees this as a very sore point of nationalist pride.
Well, this story has legs. China on Tuesday called on U.S. officials not to allow the Taiwan president next month to pass through the U.S. en route to Guatemala, one of its few diplomatic allies. Could this also possibly pose a problem, especially Mr. Trump being in New York?
It could pose a problem, yes. Obviously, the fact that the Chinese have made that request of the current administration also puts the United States in this very strange position where you'll have an outgoing government. I believe this is taking place before the inauguration or scheduled to take place before the inauguration. You'll have an outgoing president and the president-elect potentially quarreling over an important issue of foreign policy. In the past, Taiwanese presidents, while they don't carry out formal visits in the United States, are permitted generally to stage layovers. The Trump team would be very strongly against the United States acquiescing to this specific Chinese demand not to allow Tsai to have a customary layover. But I think this will be one of the issues. There'll be a bellwether again of where the Trump administration plans to take U.S. ties with Taiwan.
Ankit Panda said some of President-elect Trump's support recalibrating U.S. ties with Taiwan, including greater defense ties, perhaps a free trade agreement, and increased people-to-people contacts. He warned that could freeze U.S.-China relations. Also, 70-year-old six-term Iowa Governor Terry Branstad has been selected by Mr. Trump to be the next U.S. ambassador to Beijing. President Xi Jinping, described by Branstad as a longtime friend, visited Iowa back in 2012. The Kurdish regional government in northern Iraq has mounted costly rescues of women and girls kidnapped by Islamic State militants, spending tens of thousands of dollars to fund these operations. Upon their return, however, many women say they feel emotionally and physically devastated. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from just outside Dohuk in Kurdish Iraq.
Rescued only late last month, Bahar tells a story of another grandmother, like herself, who was held by Islamic State militants for more than 2 years. The woman, she says, complained and was beaten with a stick.
Living there was all about fear. They would come and take the girls or whoever they wanted. They would beat us. They would hurt us. They would tear apart families.
Young women, she explains, were sold for marriage, a euphemism for sexual slavery. Victims say even as captives, with almost no capacity to resist, they were raped violently.
The most difficult of this is when they rape 10 or 12-year-old girls. They would take babies from their mother's arms and chop off their heads. The things they have done to us, God would not accept it.
Yazidi cities and villages lie largely in ruins, and rescued victims often return to find their homes destroyed and families living in camps or abandoned villages. And as the Iraqi army pushes into Mosul, hoping to expel IS, officials say the militants are further isolating their hostages, making it harder than ever to conduct rescue operations. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Dohuk, Kurdish Iraq.
Wednesday was the 75th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. From 5 years ago, International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke with survivor Charles Ellis of Jacksonville, Florida. Ellis was just 19 years old and a seaman on board the USS Pennsylvania at the time of the attack.
I had breakfast, and I was on my way to my cleaning station. And all of a sudden, the alarm sounded. And when that sounded, that was general alarm, and you knew something was up. And that's when I went to my battle station.
When you say your battle station, what was that?
My battle station was in a 14-inch turret.
And then what happened?
Then, as far as I can see, as I remember it, now this is when the bombing started, and many Japanese planes came in. They were coming in from all directions, and there was a lot of them, because they were, and all in all, in that first wave of Japanese airplanes, there was about 183 or something like that airplanes, so there was a lot of airplanes. But not only were they attacking Pearl Harbor, but they were attacking the other bases, Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps bases all around the island of Oahu. So there were quite a few, but they seemed to, like they congregated on Pearl Harbor, and they were coming in from all directions.
Now, did you know right away they were Japanese?
So they were coming in so low that you couldn't miss them with that red insignia on them.
In the days beforehand, or soon beforehand, was there a threat by the Japanese? Had you been alerted to that there might be an attack, or there was perhaps some concern about growing hostility between the two countries?
Well, see, being a seaman on the ship, they wouldn't tell us anything anyhow. But there was no indication of any problem.
Once the attack started, what was it like? Did you just keep firing guns at the Japanese planes?
That's all we could do. We were firing the guns. We were very fortunate. We were sitting right there, and we were firing our 5-inch guns and machine gun fire, and just firing it at this. Firing at those airplanes that were coming in from all directions.
And how long did the attack last?
It lasted approximately an hour.
And were any of the people around you hit?
Oh, yeah. Believe me. Well, it had to be that the Pennsylvania, and we, I praise the Lord to this day, that we were sitting in dry dock, so they couldn't sink us. But we had two destroyers sitting in the dry dock in front of us. And they were hit, and badly hit. One of them was completely destroyed, and the other one was badly damaged. So they're right close by, and there was another destroyer right close by, the Shaw, and it was damaged. And then we had, and of the eight battleships that we had there at Pearl Harbor, of them, five of them were sunk. So there was a lot of ships destroyed around there.
Recollections from Pearl Harbor survivor Charles Ellis on this 75th anniversary of the attack. You'll find much more on our website at voanews.com. Be sure as well to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And while you're online, check out our Facebook page. It's VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. We'll unearth some bluegrass music in just a moment, but first, U.S. financial markets continue to push higher and set new records, as VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino shares the latest developments from New York with us.
What's interesting is the tone is changing. We're seeing sectors like telecom, real estate, consumer discretionary, and tech leading the way, and they were the ones that were the laggards back in November. Financials, they're also continuing to perform well. Goldman Sachs has had a fantastic run. Wells Fargo just hit a 52-week high, and that's despite that PR disaster that it had a few months ago with the fake accounts. So we're really seeing strength across the board. Industrials and energy, they've been relative outperformers so far for the month of December. I also find it's interesting that the ETF that tracks bonds is also at session highs. And typically you see the inverse when equities are trading higher. So I'm curious to see how that plays out. But let's take a look at what's happening globally. Now, the Dow Jones made another all-time high today. This is the 12th new high since the election, which is 19 days ago, trading days, that is. The S&P has made only 5 new highs over this time, but it closed about a point away from its new high yesterday. So that momentum is continuing throughout the trading sessions. Not to be undone, the Russell 2000, which are small cap stocks, that continues to make new highs. And it's not just U.S. strength. Yesterday, the Russian index closed an all-time high. The French CAC, the German DAX closed at their highest point since December of last year. Nikkei is near 2016 highs, and the Euro Stoxx index breaking above downward sloping trend lines, which we haven't seen since early 2015. So this is a broad-based global rally, and it's another sign that the equity bull market seems to be alive and well with the surprise President-elect Trump win.
There's been a little bit of talk among the commentators about Donald Trump's tweeting. Yesterday, he tweeted about Boeing and the contract for Air Force One. Today, he tweeted about pharmaceuticals, and it has a little bit of an edge to it for some investors.
Sure. Well, and we saw that at the open where the biotech index and the larger pharma indexes were down about 3% at the open. They've recovered since then. But it's interesting because CEOs that we have spoken to, that we've seen on network, have said that they have never in their entire careers paid attention to Facebook and Twitter the way that they have with President-elect Trump, because there's actual policy coming across the social media airwaves. And I find that to be it's just a new era that we're entering in terms of business and trade, in addition to how he uses social media in terms of his policy. And what we see on a global level regarding trade and economics is going to be the story for 2017 and beyond, particularly as it relates to China.
One more thing for investors to pay attention to. Be sure to pay attention to Jill Malandrino on Twitter at Jill Malandrino. Jill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The eastern U.S. state of Tennessee is home to some famous music venues. From the blues capital of Beale Street in the heart of Memphis to the Ryman Auditorium, often referred to as the mother church of country music, to the rolling hills of the Cumberland Plateau. That's where Mike Osborne checked out one of the world's most unusual performance spaces.
On most Saturdays, between 500 and 600 music fans from all over the world trek nearly a kilometer into the Cumberland Caverns to enjoy an American original music form 110 meters below ground. Bluegrass Underground was launched in 2008. The show features artists playing the so-called American roots music developed by immigrants from the British Isles who settled in the hills above in the late 18th century. On this particular day, the two-hour program includes music by the modern folk band Way Down Wanderers and the bluegrass band Flat Lonesome. The performances are staged in a large cavern referred to as the Volcano Room. Surprisingly, the room's acoustics are nearly perfect. That fact wasn't lost on the Tennessee music promoter who originated the Bluegrass Underground, Todd Mayo.
Inside the cave, we took the tour, and you get down into the Volcano Room, and there's this giant chandelier. And I looked up, and I looked around, and I said to the tour guide, do y'all have live music around here? And she said, no, but that'd be a good idea. And it just sort of all came to me.
More than 180,000 guests later, Bluegrass Underground is gathering an international following. That recognition is due in no small measure to the worldwide distribution of performances by the U.S. public TV system, PBS.
We've had people from Ireland, and Japan, and they literally said they came to America. The impetus was to come to this cave and to see this show.
As the audience filed out of the cave, bluegrass fan Gwen Lania said he did feel a bit queasy being so far underground, but also said the music seemed to fit the setting.
The bluegrass that we saw today, it kind of blended. It might not be a venue for all kinds of music, but it was certainly appropriate for the day.
And the cave setting also matched the nature-themed songs often performed by the Way Down Wanderers. Lead singer Austin Thompson was impressed as well with the cave's natural acoustics.
Yeah, I thought it was really great. I mean, on both sides of the spectrum, being on stage and as a listener in the audience, you know, it was really, really full, really full sound.
Todd Mayo says he hopes in the near future to give music fans who attend the show an even fuller experience. He wants to develop a week-long Tennessee adventure that would include visiting some of the state's many scenic parks and forests. For VOA News, I'm Mike Osborne at Cumberland Caverns.
You've been listening to International Edition. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer is Jimmy Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us today. We invite you to come back and have a wonderful day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An ISIL suicide bomber recently detonated a truck filled with explosives at a roadside service station in Hilla, Iraq, killing nearly 80 people and injuring many more. The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms this outrageous terrorist attack. Many of those killed were pilgrims returning from commemorating the Shia observance of Arba'in in the city of Karbala. The annual rite is a commemoration of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, a revered 7th-century Shiite figure. Millions of Shiites have flowed through southern Iraq in recent days for what may be the world's largest religious pilgrimage, larger even than the Hajj in Saudi Arabia. This pilgrimage has been a frequent target of Sunni extremist groups like ISIL and its predecessor, Al-Qaeda, in Iraq. The United States extends its deepest sympathies to the families of the victims, as well as to all of Iraq, for this cruel violence, which was clearly intended to stoke sectarian tensions. The United States remains steadfast in its partnership with the Iraqi people and government, and this attack only serves to strengthen American resolve in defeating ISIL. The U.S. extends its deepest condolences to the victims' families and friends. These murders are yet another example of ISIL's contempt for human life and its efforts to sow discord and division among the Iraqi people. The U.S. partnership with Iraq and its people, who serve on the front lines of this global fight, remains steadfast and unwavering. State Department spokesperson John Kirby said, "The United States is in close contact with Iraqi authorities, and we stand committed to supporting Iraqi security forces as they continue to take the fight to Daesh and bring to justice those responsible for these despicable crimes."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
is for, what's